One of the recurring challenges that this series addresses is translation. We have rich research on learning and development, but what happens when that research travels into practice? Too often, complexity gets flattened. The science becomes a checklist, a strategy, a slogan about what works. Stephanie McMahon's work offers a different path. Stephanie is a learning scientist at the University of Queensland in Australia and the architect of the Partner Schools program, an innovative year-long research practitioner partnership that brings educators and researchers together around school-identified problems of practice. She also brings her 20 years of experience as a classroom teacher and school leader, which gives her work a grounded understanding of what educators actually face. Stephanie's argument is not that practitioners need less complexity, it is that they need better support to work with complexity. Educators do not need research handed to them as prescriptions. They need principles, the language, the time, and the partnership to connect research to their own students, their own communities, and their own professional judgment. That is what the Partner Schools program is designed to do. Educators and researchers learn together. They identify a real problem of practice, they gather evidence and context, they reflect, revise, and build shared knowledge. The goal is not simply research-informed practice, it is also practice-informed research. In the first part of our conversation, Stephanie helps us understand what genuine knowledge mobilization looks like. She shows why context matters, why educator agency matters, and why deep professional learning can strengthen not only practice, but also teacher well-being and professional satisfaction. In the second part, Stephanie turns to learning environments themselves. She introduces the idea of social synchrony, the shared sense of connection that can emerge in a group, and her framework for building social synchrony through familiarity, affect, competence, and voice and choice. For practitioners, Stephanie's work asks, are we giving educators the time to think deeply or only to comply? Are we using research to narrow professional judgment or to strengthen it? Are we designing classrooms and adult learning spaces where people can connect, contribute, take risks, and learn with and from one another? Let's begin. Your recent work, as well as the award address that you gave after the Australian Council for Educational Leadership gave you the Queen's Miller Grassi Award for Outstanding Education Leadership, named something this whole series is wrestling with: the risk that rich, complex research on learning gets, that I quote you, reduced to singular constructs, end quote, when it reaches practice. That fuels debates about what really works, both in Australia as well as in the US and really worldwide. As someone who sits at the intersection of research and practice every day in your work, how do you think about preserving the complexity without making the science feel that it's inaccessible or overwhelming to people who must put it into practice?
David, I think this is a really important question, and I think perhaps this is going to be one of our greatest challenges in this space, is grappling with this complexity. And I was listening to the podcast the other day, and I think it was Carol Lee who was talking about the abstract nature of complexity and how it makes it really difficult for us to make sense of that and bring it into the embodied work of educators. But I also, when I was listening to Carol speak, she talked about how we actually see this complexity every day and we work with this complexity every day, but we don't really have the language or the framework to explain it. So when we're introducing something that seems new, I think in practice, such as the science of learning might seem like it's a new idea for educators, I think what we need to start with is positioning it as something that's actually already embedded in very good pedagogy. There's so much about what educators do that is embracing the complexity of learning. And I think what the science of learning can do is give them that theory and that evidence base and that framework for making sense of that complexity. So the way that I approach this, because this is certainly a conversation we have, whether it's with our individual partner schools, whether it's the work that I've been doing across a whole sector with Brisbane Catholic Education across all of their 147 schools, has been, we're busy people, there's lots going on. How do we make sense of all of this? Can't you just give us something really simple that we can grab onto and take away and just put into practice straight away? And it's very tempting to do that, I think. But instead, I think for sustained, deep, meaningful engagement with the science of learning and with evidence-informed ways of thinking about learning, we need to empower educators through understanding, giving them that deep understanding of the principles that underpin the science of learning. So I often start from, what are the key principles that are important for us to have a shared understanding of? And then use those principles to align with, what do you already do in practice? What do you already know? What do you already value? What do you already take into the everyday work that you do that you know has a positive impact on the young people that you work with? And let's look at how that aligns with what we know from the science of learning. So it's not about something new. And I think in many ways, educators have been doing this work for a very long time. And when we look to our Indigenous cultures and communities, they think about learning in this way, and they've been doing this way of learning for a very long time. And I think in a way, the science is just catching up in terms of being able to provide that really clear and complex evidence base that this is what learning and good teaching looks like in practice. So part of the way in which I work with educators is, let's align this with what you already do, but let's also not think that we're, think of this as a linear journey, that I'm at this point in my professional learning, and if I learn this new knowledge, then I'll be at this point. It's about thinking about learning as being continuous and cyclical and iterative, that there, yes, we're all working towards that notion of expertise or mastery in our practice, but really, will we ever get there? Because there's always new things to learn and new things to engage with. The introduction has completely changed the way we all think and work. So we're all learning in that process. So I'd like to remind all of our educators and engage in that process of deep reflection about who we are as practitioners and how we're learning and how we're engaging with new knowledge to continue to inform practice rather than think of it as just adding on to practice. I think another point that I wanted to make in relation to this question was around the idea of what works. And you know, you hear a lot of conversations in education and in the media about using what works or using high impact strategies. And I worry a little bit about that language. And I worry that it's a bit of a distraction from the importance of understanding context. And we can look at what the research can tell us in terms of what the evidence has shown when it's been collected in highly controlled contexts. And when we're talking about the science of learning, and we're talking about the interdisciplinary lens from neuroscience, psychology, education, some of that research is from very controlled lab-based contexts. It's not from a classroom in outback Queensland of year three students. It's not from an inner city school. So I think as part of this conversation about how do we engage with this complexity is that we remind ourselves and our partners about thinking about context and that our educators in those schools are the experts in those contexts. They know their students, they know their community, they know their context. So we need to bring that into the conversation around the science of learning as well and what that evidence base is about. So For me, in addressing this translational challenge of complexity, it's about creating the conditions for our educators to think deeply about who they are, what their practice is, what they know and bring to this new learning, and what they can take from this new learning. So empowering them through that kind of grounding of good pedagogy in both evidence from the science of learning and evidence and understanding of context.
I've had the privilege of being at a convening of the University of Queensland's Partner Schools program. And it was so impressive. And not just the content that was provided to people, but what was really impressive was the way in which people from the partner schools were engaging with the content and reflecting on what they had been doing in the previous years, including leveraging earlier content that they had processed in their own work. That work that you do centers on the mutually beneficial relationships that can occur between researchers and educators that can be at the heart of knowledge mobilization. It's not just delivering findings or telling people what works, but building practitioner agency and capability together. Can you describe what the partner school process actually looks like in practice?
Sure. So the Partner Schools program was intentionally designed to try and address A, the complexity of the science of learning, but really to address that long-standing gap between research and practice. And it came about because, as a former educator myself of 20 years in the classroom as an educator and a school leader, I recognize the value of research, but also recognize the challenges of engaging with research when you're working full-time in a busy school context. And when I started in the science of learning journey in my academic career during my PhD, I really discovered how incredibly powerful the science of learning is. And I could see the amazing potential it had for supporting great practice in schools. But I was frustrated by the inability of that information to cross those boundaries between research and practice. So I investigated, what are these barriers? What gets in the way of research making it into practice? And a number of barriers that I discovered were that the context in which research is conducted is often very different from where it's applied. And that is not only a barrier in itself, but it's already also a perceived barrier by educators that they see that it's not relevant to them in their context. Another barrier was access. A lot of educators just don't have the access to research. It's often behind paywalls or it's in inaccessible language that they find challenging, unfamiliar. Another barrier is that the nature of the evidence doesn't always relate to the context in which they're applying the work. Time is always going to be a challenge for educators, and this is a barrier. And then the fifth barrier that I encountered in the literature, which I found really fascinating, was that teachers experience a sense of low self-efficacy when engaging with research. Then there are also some promising approaches to knowledge mobilization or translation, things like building ongoing relationships, investing in continual professional learning, grounding the exploration of the research within a problem of practice identified within that a school context. So the Partner Schools program was really about merging these ideas and trying to reduce those barriers and enhance those enablers. And essentially, what it is a year-long partnership between researchers and practitioners, where schools, a small group of leaders and educators from the schools, work with us on a school-identified problem of practice. And then we engage with them in a process of rigorous inquiry framed by the science of learning. So they're learning about the science of learning through the science of learning by doing their own research and gathering their own evidence in their own context so that they're making sense of what this research actually can mean and can look like within their own contexts. So part of that process was that I really wanted educators to shift from their traditional role as educators and practitioners and build that capacity and that mindset to be researchers in practice. But at the same time, we need to remember that whilst educators are doing the heavy lifting when it comes to knowledge mobilization, they're at the forefront of putting research into practice. Researchers have a responsibility as well. And the importance of relationships here in this program is not just for the benefit of practitioners, but also for the benefit of researchers. I wanted the researchers to build a better understanding and awareness and appreciation of the complexity of educational practice, of being in the classroom, of being a school leader, of enacting policy and strategic practice. So it's about building that shared understanding through dialogue and through ongoing relationships. The intention of that is that we can shift our practitioners into that space of research-informed practice that is meaningful and relevant in their context, but also that we can drive our research agenda through practice-informed research. And that has been a really powerful outcome of this work. And I can give one specific example of that. We had a school who was very interested in the idea of curiosity in their students. And they saw that their students were quite passively engaged, that they were not particularly excited about learning. And they approached it through the lens of curiosity and wondering, are our students curious? And if not, why not? And what can we be doing as educators to pique that curiosity and spark that curiosity in our students? And one of the surveys that they did with their students from year 5 to year 12, looking at dispositions for curiosity and engagement in curiosity across different kind of constructs within their learning. And we noticed this very significant dip from year 7 and 8, but really bottoming out in year 9 and then slowly coming back up. And we were quite fascinated by this dip. So we started to look at some other literature to see, is this evidenced in other areas? And certainly that is what we found. We then started to see that there was this dip in academic well-being and a dip in, a sense of self during these sort of early or transitional years, going from our primary school years into our early secondary years. So that finding from our partner school actually then led to a whole body of work that's been led by one of our wonderful cognitive neuroscientists, Dr. Natasha Matthews, who's looked into this notion of the adolescent dip across those transition years from year 6, year 7, year 8, and into year 9. And in particular, looking at what are the factors that contribute to academic well-being and what might be the role of emotion regulation and metacognition in protecting students against that dip. So it's a really nice illustration of how by bringing educators and researchers together in a continual partnership, in rich conversations with one another, that we cannot just benefit our educators, but we can benefit our researchers and build really contemporary and in the moment programs of work that have direct and powerful implications for practice. That's a really important aspect of this reciprocal outcome of this work. What I also noticed in the work that I've been doing, in the initial couple of years of running the partner schools, I was interviewing, I think it was back in about 2019, and I was interviewing some educators about their experience of the Partner Schools program. And one of them said to me, Steph, when I started on this project, I was really nervous because researchers are like gods. They're in their ivory towers. They're up here and they're these experts of knowledge. And she held a hand up quite high. And she said, and I'm just a teacher. And I'm just in a school, and she held her other hand down quite low. And that visual representation of the disconnect between researchers and educators and the visual representation of the way they perceive their value in the conversation, I found very confronting, but I also identified with that because I myself, as a teacher of 20 years, also had always felt that. So part of the goals of the program has been to really shift that perception and to bring educators and their voices to the table to share their expertise and their insights and their wisdom and their compassion and their passion for teaching and learning, and to build researchers' understanding of how important educators' voice is in this conversation. So the program is very much designed to create those conditions where educators and researchers are of equal and valued contribution and to learn with and from one another through this process of reciprocal relationships and knowledge, shared knowledge building. And so in thinking about that, I really recognize the importance of any sort of work like this really needs to tap into teacher professional identity and invite our practitioners to think about who they are as educators, what's important to them, what do they believe, what do they value, what knowledge and experience do they bring, and how does this new learning or this additional learning enhance that and build that out. So an intentional part of this work is very much around inviting educators to be deeply reflective and to think deeply with, I guess, with that real sense of who am I and why is this important to me? Rekindling that passion for why we do what we do in the first place. I think it was Mary Helen who talked about the idea that deep learning is about thinking and feeling and meaning making. And that has become a real theme of this body of work, not just with the partner schools, but across all of the work that we're doing. How do we cause thinking and feeling and meaning making, not just for students, but for the educators and the leaders who are making this work happen in schools? And in doing that process of deeply thinking, reflecting, considering professional identity, a somewhat surprising but wonderful outcome of all of this work has been what the educators have been telling us is the impact on their well-being and their professional satisfaction, that causing them to think deeply and to feel and to make meaning has given them profound joy. We often think because of that notion of time and time being a barrier, what we want to do is take things away from our educators. But our educators are actually saying, don't take away the things that give us joy. Don't take away the things that help us to think and feel. Take away the things that are not necessary, but give us that time to make meaning out of practice by drawing on research. Give us time to struggle with this complexity, to be comfortable with the complexity of learning and thinking, and give us time to have conversations with one another and with researchers and to deepen our understanding, because that is helping us not just in our practice, but it's helping us as professionals, it's helping us as people, it's enhancing their professional satisfaction, and it's making them want to stay in their job. And at a time when we're losing a lot of great teachers from the profession, I think this is a really important framing or really important dimension of perhaps a strategy for addressing teacher attrition and teacher burnout is through deep learning, thinking and feeling. So that's, I guess, that going back to your original question about the reciprocal relationships, it is about investing time and letting people build those relationships with one another to allow for those opportunities for deep learning and meaning making in practice.
There's a